This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I'd like to start by asking a rhetorical question. What does the retailer target, the U.S. Army, the New York City Police Department, and Disney World have in common? Each of these are engaged in the practice of gathering personal information, and in the case of the Army and the NYPD, attempting to destroy civic groups of activists. In Disney World in Orlando, patrons are given magic bands to wear on their wrists to avoid waiting in line. They can wave the hand over what's called a magic wand to buy food, to buy tickets for rides, but they have to hand over personal information, date of birth, address, and in the case of a child who perhaps walks in front of Cinderella on his or her birthday, they can be greeted with a happy birthday on their date of birth. Target, the retailer, sent ads to a family in Minnesota advertising maternity wear. An angry father stormed into the store and said, "Why are you sending this? I have a teenage daughter." Well, it turned out an analyst at Target had put information into their so-called pregnancy predictor test and was able to determine, based on purchase of calcium, supplements, lotion that was sent free, what trimester a female might be in her pregnancy, and they sent coupons to the teenager's family. The father came back embarrassed and said, "I'm sorry I had a fit, but you were right, my daughter's pregnant." She had not mustered the courage to tell him. In New York City, a group called Critical Mass, and I believe you have Critical Mass monthly bike rides in Santa Barbara, for years had friendly rides, often escorted by the police. And I'm going to actually read a section of my book to explain what happened. After several years of having these bicycle rides to promote alternatives to transportation, a bicycle-friendly culture, something changed in New York. Government response in New York bicycle rides reveals how threatening community organizing can be to power structures. Critical Mass rides took place in Manhattan for a decade and were publicized by the grassroots environmental organization Time's Up, a nonprofit group, and even the New York City Department of Transportation. By 2004, thousands of New Yorkers had participated in the events, attracting scant police response. Police operations escalated markedly, however, as New York prepared for the 2004 Republican National Convention. It was a politically charged moment. The new police commissioner, Ray Kelly, and his NYPD intelligence chief, quote, decided they would have to push beyond what many Americans and New Yorkers had come to think of as acceptable boundaries for police investigation of political groups. When Kelly was appointed commissioner in 2002, he made it a priority to weaken long-standing court-imposed restrictions on spying of political groups. He persuaded a judge that, quote, the entire resources of the NYPD must be available to conduct investigations into political activity and intelligence-related issues. He cleared the path for the intelligence division to, quote, go out and find the groups, conduct surveillance, and penetrate them. In the run-up to the RNC, detectives traveled to more than 10 states, and this is their quote, to hang out with the loosely organized anarchists, direct action provocateurs, libertarian clowns, conscientious protesters, and potential killers setting their sights on Madison Square Garden, where the RNC was going to be. Such rhetoric reveals an open effort to propagate false associations between constitutionally protected political expression and criminal acts such as homicide. And what happened was the NYPD brought out their anti-terrorism gear, a helicopter. They bought new scooters so that police could ride scooters alongside with the critical mass bike rides. They infiltrated the rides. They had police officers dressed up as activists, trying to change the direction that the riders would go so they'd go through red lights and could then get ticketed for infractions. Now, people started to take notices of what was happening because every final Friday of the month, the critical mass riders would gather, and there would be hundreds of police in scooters, in vans with darkened windows, videotaping the bike riders. So the New York Times, in an editorial focusing on the disproportionate resources, anti-terrorism resources, devoted to critical mass, wrote, "The New York police, who deem critical mass an illegal parade and have drafted a law that would essentially ban it, have seemed obsessed with the rides since one coincided with the Republican National Convention. An amazing array of police resources, scooters, vans, unmarked cars, and helicopters chase a quarry that looks like fish in a barrel. Police vehicles race the wrong way and on sidewalks, posing a greater public danger than the bikers." And in a case in Washington State, several years ago, anti-war activists started realizing that police were showing up to demonstrations, actions of civil disobedience that they were calling for, but that they hadn't announced publicly. They had a listserv, and they started to suspect that one of the newer members of the group, who was actually managing the listserv, might not be who he claimed to be. So they looked on Facebook. They actually found his real name. He worked for a fusion center, and a fusion center is one of the entities created after the events of 9/11 in an effort recommended by the 9/11 Commission to streamline and coordinate better intelligence between different levels of law enforcement and local businesses. So this person named John Towery, that was his activist name, had taken control of the listserv and was letting the local fusion center and the U.S. Army know that there were going to be acts of civil disobedience. So the activist did a lot more research, sent for Freedom of Information Act requests, and found out that, in the Army's words, they were intentionally trying to neutralize a specific peace group. It was a port militarization group that worked to stop, weapons being shipped from the Port of Washington. And in their words, they wanted to attack friendships, engage in patterns of false arrests, and break up lawful First Amendment-protected assemblies. Why is this important? I think that it shows something that's been going on for decades, but that has definitely accelerated after the events of 9/11, how corporations work hand in hand with government to collect information, not only on all of us, but especially on people who are politically active and who engage in drawing attention to corporate malfeasance, animal rights, environmental activists, and others, become easy targets. Especially with new anti-terrorism legislation and public fears of another attack, they become especially vulnerable. Currently, our current surveillance state, with corporations often contracting for the government, and the government contracts out approximately 70% of its intelligence gathering functions to private contractors. I think this is at odds with notions of a democracy, because what we're seeing is a shift where the government is increasingly shrouded in secrecy about how it performs its intelligence activities. But more and more, the government knows everything about us. We have more classified documents. We have the so-called state secrets doctrine and government immunity, so that during the Bush administration, when we learned about a warrantless wiretapping program in groups such as the Center for Constitutional Rights, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the ACLU, filed lawsuits saying this creates a chilling effect. We're doing legal work. We can't talk with our, members who may be in Guantanamo or who may be targeted under terrorism legislation for what they've done. We can't have free and open conversations with them. The attorney-client privilege is compromised, and it means that we have to invest more resources to either meet with people, to travel to other countries, to not conduct our business on the telephone. But what happened was those cases were dismissed because the government said you can't prove it. And we have misrepresentations by our leaders, such as James Clapper, intelligence director, saying we're not collecting data on Americans. And then we find out that, of course, they are. How did we get to this state where there's such an imbalance between the people and the government? We have a private sector intent on maximizing profits and a government intent on maintaining a state of perpetual war, used in the name of preventing future terrorist attacks. It's easily done because we have a public that's fearful of another attack. We have the internet. We have convenient personal devices that we've all become so reliant on and that offer many wonderful benefits. We have a nebulous enemy threat and a shift to preemptive policing, where U.S. investigators are advocating for a robust anti-terrorism agenda, and where they say that we need to give up our civil liberties in order to protect the country. And we have a government that is pressing communications companies to store and turn over more and more of our information. The problem is that information that's in the public domain, and increasingly more of our personal records are digitized, information that's given over when you buy a book with your credit card or when you rent a movie. If you saw a particular movie last week, you buy a particular book this week, you sign a political petition, each of those elements alone may not be deemed sensitive. But when you put them together, you can develop a profile. And the government and corporations may target you for your political views. The information that they gather may contain inaccuracies, and we know that a lot of it does, but we have no way to correct that information, no way to know what they're collecting on us. If we have a medical condition, we may be discriminated against. We may not be granted health insurance. In the future, something that we've done last year but that's been stored for many years may turn out to be criminalized. The problems with a current NSA metadata program, despite the fact that the leaders say they don't know what we're saying, they nonetheless know about our associations. It does not make us safer. It impinges on a core value of privacy that the framers knew were so essential to personal liberties. Our ability to talk, our ability to associate without the government watching. Privacy is still a vibrant notion. Many say that young people who were raised on personal gadgets don't care about privacy, but that's not true. We still use passwords on our computers. We still have curtains in our homes. I don't think any of us wants a world without privacy. The government gets a lot of its data from private telecommunications companies and others. Corporations can be forced to hand over information. The government can ask for it informally, or they can compel it through subpoenas or other administrative measures. and they can buy it outright from data aggregators. I'm going to read a short piece about data aggregators. It sounds like scene direction for a film. Maria wakes up, grabs the remote control, and tunes in to an alternative rock radio station. She gets up, goes to the kitchen, grabs a bottle of water, and goes to the third bedroom, which doubles as the workout room. She runs on the treadmill for 30 minutes. That's a quote. Maria's morning is part of a short narrative that some corporations use to help develop consumer marketing strategies. At a glance, retailers can view information about prospective patrons categorized according to stages in their lives, such as getting married, having a child, or readying for retirement. Descriptive summaries include such specifics as the amount of time spent online shopping for flat-screen TVs to the kind of beer they drink. Maria falls in the group of financially comfortable young adults who spend money on items for themselves, their children, or their friends' children. They grew up in the wake of 9/11, after the debut of the TV show American Idol. They go to bed around 11:30 after a half hour of Pilates and watching Scrubs reruns. This is the so-called life stage segmentation system, a Personics classic cluster perspectives, the brainchild of Axiom. Known as a data aggregator, Axiom is one of many corporations comprising a multi-billion dollar industry that collects and sells personal data to third parties for targeted advertising and other purposes. Clients include financial service, direct marketing, technology, telecoms, insurance, media, retail, healthcare, travel companies. As New York Times reporter Natasha Singer has written of Axiom, it peers deeper into American life than the FBI or the IRS. If you are an American adult, the odds are it knows things about you, like your age, race, sex, weight, height, marital status, education level, politics, buying habits, household health worries, vacation dreams, and so on. And the U.S. government is a client. A few months after the Ed Snowden revelations, Axiom came out with a website called About the Data, and it lets you go in to see what data they have on you, or at least the data they elect to show. Of course, you have to put your social security number in, and it gives you the option to correct any misinformation so that, in effect, you're giving them more information. But I think, from their perspective, they saw that Ed Snowden was working with corporations, was a private contractor with Booz Allen, and had to do some damage repair. So it was clever on their part. Data mining and data profiling uses statistical techniques and programmatic algorithms to discern relationships within the information. So that, for example, the book I bought, thank you, the DVD I rented, my medical, what I bought, what prescriptions, all of those things can create a snapshot of who I am. The Senate Commerce Committee, in a recent report, criticized data brokers, as they're also called, saying they operate in a shroud of secrecy. And some of the categories they came up with for labeling people seem to focus on at-risk populations, such as the poor, the elderly, raising questions about whether information they gather and how it's stored and used can result in things like predatory business practices. ChoicePoint, one of the big aggregators, contracts with at least 35 government agencies. An $8 million contract with the Department of Justice permits FBI agents to access companies' database of personal information on us, as do contracts with the IRS, the Drug Enforcement Administration, the Marshals Service, the Bureau of Citizenship and Immigration Services, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. And these are just the contracts we know about, some of them. Of the 70% of the intelligence work that's farmed out to private industry, and there are nearly 2,000 private security firms engaged in the business of surveillance and counterterrorism, there's enormous duplication and waste. And those fusion centers that I mentioned exist in over 30 states. They get our data from state driver's licensing agencies, hospitals, schools, credit bureaus, banks. They have a database that all centers can access by law enforcement, by corporations that they're working with, and they've been widely criticized by the government accounting office and other entities for being highly wasteful, ineffective, and extremely expensive, so that the members of the 9/11 Commission who envisioned and called for greater cooperation and efficiency in our post-9/11 information intelligence gathering efforts, unfortunately, it seems to have created more bureaucracy. There's a codependent corporate government intelligence state. It's sustained by a perpetual war on terror, much like the so-called war on drugs that we had decades ago and that still is putting people away with draconian sentences and ruining communities. Instead of going after perpetrators of a criminal act, we vilified other nations and peoples and are now turning on our own domestic activists and making suspects in a way of many of us. There's a revolving door between government intelligence officials and the corporate defense industry. Something like 80% of the 108 three- and four-star generals and admirals who retired from 2004 to 2008 then took jobs as private contractors and defense consultants, many of whom continue to advise the Department of Defense on policy. Much of my work at the National Lawyers Guild, an organization that was spied on for nearly three decades by the FBI, who tried to label us subversive. We defended a lot of individuals who were targeted during the McCarthy hearings and, in general, dissidents in this country. Our offices were bugged. Our members' garbage was gone through. Our phones were tapped. We had an infiltrator serving as a staff person in our Washington office, but they never labeled us subversive because they didn't have the evidence. But we did represent people whose views were often unpopular in terms of the government. And I think the danger of collecting, storing, and making vulnerable vast amounts of personal information is that the government has historically targeted dissidents. It has targeted the free press. And it's still doing that. Corporations now invest great resources in watching activists. They have private so-called risk mitigation companies who help other businesses identify threats to profits by regularly monitoring political activists. And in 2010, Jeremy Scahill of The Nation wrote that the biotech giant company Monsanto hired subsidiaries of the mercenary firm Blackwater to spy on and infiltrate organizing against company practices. And just to go back to that case in Washington State with the Army spying on activists, I forgot to mention that that case is winding its way through the courts. There was a famous case in the 70s called Laird v. Tatum, a Supreme Court case, where the Army, as they had been doing, was amassing data on Americans and spying on college campuses and political dissidents. But in Laird, they couldn't prove damages. They couldn't prove that the spying had resulted in a harm. Fortunately, in the current case, which is called Tauri v. Panagakos, they can prove a harm, and a judge said the case can proceed because the peace group that they infiltrated was destroyed. The police followed members of the group, arrested them on bogus charges over a period of years, I believe. One person was kicked out of his house. The group was destroyed. Their free assemblies were ruined, and the group has ceased to exist. surveillance of animal rights and environmental activists is a top FBI priority. In Great Britain, 10 female environmental activists sued Scotland Yard in 2011, alleging they'd been lured into long-term relationships with undercover officers there from 1987 to 2010. Two of the male officers fathered children with women that they were monitoring. In the U.S., our agents also infiltrate these movements and devote enormous resources to doing so. And one law, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, was passed several years ago, making harsh penalties, setting in place harsh penalties for animal rights activists. So targeting a specific group who cause there to be a loss of profits to a business engaged in an animal enterprise. So it could be a puppy mill or a store that carries milk or eggs. That law has been challenged as being an unconstitutional impediment to free speech because so many activists don't understand the law, and it's vaguely written. But I think enormous resources over the last several decades have been devoted to portraying animal rights activists as terrorists. And there's a person named Will Potter in D.C. who runs a wonderful website called Green It's the New Red that really talks about this with a good deal of humor, but shows how vegans are portrayed by the FBI as would-be terrorists, with images of them with unshaved legs and wearing masks and, you know, freeing bunny rabbits and holding vegan potlucks. And an FBI agent had this to say in a document that Will got under a FOIA request. In 2005, the agent wrote that the structure of animal rights groups makes them easy to infiltrate and discredit. And remember, discrediting and disrupting are exactly what the FBI did under its illegal counterintelligence programs when J. Edgar Hoover was head of the FBI. This agent wrote, "The animal rights movement does little research on newcomers into the movement and basically goes with its gut instinct as to whether a person is an informant or not. Organizers of the animal rights movement can be discredited and removed from the scene by planting rumors that they are plants and or informants." And it's worth noting that in New York, I mentioned how the NYPD intelligence unit focused on critical mass and a local group called Time's Up, which does bicycle riding and environmental work, and is one of the few really grassroots groups left in New York that focuses on the environment. And they infiltrated Time's Up, and then years later, opened an investigation into its executive director, Bill DePaola, who lives in my neighborhood, the East Village of New York, happy-go-lucky guy, you know, fixes bikes, holds workshops. And a few months ago, you may have read Matt Apuzzo, the two AP Associated Press reporters who uncovered how the NYPD was spying on Muslim communities, recently wrote a book, and in their documents they found out that the local police intelligence unit had opened an investigation on Bill because, well, he rides a bike, and a friend of his, Thaddeus, a so-called anarchist who actually, in 2004, the NYPD circulated a list of, I think it was the 50 most well-known anarchists in the country. They might be coming to New York, and Thaddeus was one of them. Well, after the bombing or an explosive of a Times Square recruiting center a couple of years ago, Thaddeus, who also rides a bike, posted an article on a website about it. So the NYPD, who must have been watching Thaddeus for years, knew he was a friend of Bill's, opened investigation on Bill and another member of Time's Up. And the New York Times did a couple of articles saying that it was on very tenuous evidence that a terrorism-related investigation got opened. I wanted to mention that as the Guild, my organization had been infiltrated. They had at one time over 1,000 FBI informants reporting on and disrupting our meetings. And this was in the 50s and 60s. Repeatedly broke into our office and the private law offices of some of our key members. As well, other legal organizations were spied on and continue to be monitored now. The People's Law Office in Chicago, who represented the Black Panthers, the Young Lords, Students for a Democratic Society years ago. The FBI actually rented a room across the street from their office, filmed them, read their mail. Their local so-called Red Squad monitored them daily, taunted them. And in a 1981 court order, the FBI, CIA, and military intelligence were told they needed to end their political spying and harassment. Spying on lawyers chills that attorney-client privilege. It adds a burden in how to communicate with the clients, as I mentioned. And in my organization, it sends a message, because we have law students as members, we're a bar association, it discourages young lawyers from taking cases. And you may know of Lynn Stewart, who was also a Guild member, who was just let out of prison on compassionate release, but had been convicted of aiding terrorism for basically violating what's called a special administrative measure. It allowed her to get in to see her client, so-called blind sheikh, who was convicted of conspiring to blow up landmarks in New York City. And in order to see him, she had to sign this piece of paper saying she wouldn't communicate his message to the outside world. She issued a press release at one point when Janet Reno was Attorney General and Bill Clinton was president, and they said to her, don't do it again. You violated the SAMs. But then when Bush came into presidency, Attorney General John Ashcroft came up to New York and appeared on the David Letterman show and said he was announcing the first indictment, terrorism-related indictment of an attorney, and it was Lynn Stewart. And we feel that knowing that if you zealously represent, you know, putting aside the fact she did violate an administrative measure, one presidential administration, it wasn't a crime, it was an administrative measure, but another politicized it. And I think that's damaging to democracy, as is spying on the press. I'm sure you know that two-time Pulitzer Prize winner James Risen of the New York Times found the government got his credit reports, his bank statements. They monitored his email, his phone communications with former CIA clandestine officer Jeffrey Alexander Sterling while Risen was researching his book State of War on the CIA and the Bush administration. You may have heard that Hewlett-Packard engaged in what's called pretexting. In 2005 to 2006, they hired private security companies to investigate journalists to find the source of an information leak that made HP look bad. The investigators impersonated 9 journalists from the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, other media outlets, in order to get their phone records, their social security numbers, their date of birth. They use that information to gather clues on the reporter's sources. And independent journalist from San Francisco, I believe, Josh Wolf, served over 220 days in jail for refusing to turn over video outtakes from a 2005 demonstration. Those he ultimately decided to release them to the public. I think he served more time in jail for refusing to turn something over than any other journalist. So wrapping up, I think that the apparatus that we find ourselves in right now is one that forfeits the hallmarks of good government. In becoming beholden to corporations to conduct our national intelligence, we give up oversight, quality control, transparently, and ultimately, national security. The money, the resources, the incompetence diverts from effective law enforcement efforts. The Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board recently issued a report on NSA bulk metadata, and it found there wasn't a strong enough showing of effectiveness in this program to justify altering the healthy relationship between government and citizens to one that, in essence, threatens associational freedoms so essential to democracy. But surveillance is here to stay. We've always spied on others and on ourselves. I think it's a window of opportunity to look at reform measures. We need to insist that whatever surveillance program and retention of data that needs to be done respect the principles of democracy and not be done in secrecy, meaning that we need to know what the framework of the program is. We don't need to know the particulars. We need a balance between government secrecy and public debate. Laws that protect us and keep up with advances of technology so that a father in Minnesota doesn't have to find out his daughter is pregnant from a retailer. We need whistleblower protection. I think we need to return to the days when we had attorney general guidelines for how the FBI monitors individuals. They have to have clear guidelines before they open a case. It can't just be a good faith effort, a good faith belief, as we now have, that there needs to be an investigation. And I think the Supreme Court is going to have to reinterpret certain Fourth Amendment protections to take into account the changes in technology. But most important, we each must educate ourselves about the ways that we hand over our own data, and we need to make sensible choices, informed choices, about how we do that. We must reclaim the power that now lies in the hands of government and corporations who really just care about their bottom line and who aren't beholden to the Fourth Amendment strictures against unreasonable government searches and seizures. And reclaim how we interact with technology and restoring vital relationships and in-person associations in our democracy. We cannot be afraid to meet in the streets like those peace activists did in Washington State, and to know that if we act out and engage in vigorous debate, we may be subject to anti-terrorism legislation. Thank you.
Thank you for your insightful talk. I agree. I like the sort of reforms and practical forms of resistance that you mentioned at the end. I was wondering if, in addition to those kinds of things, you see any role for a reappraisal of the events of 9/11 themselves, in sort of getting people to wake up and resist the curtailing of civil liberties and the expanded role of the executive branch, and all of these things that you were going through in your talk, that come out post 9/11, the NYPD, Ray Kelly and his measures, you're sort of talking about the NSA, the corporations and the government getting so much power from the events of 9/11, what would, do you see any role for talking about who might have been behind 9/11 in getting people to wake up for a more sort of radical form of resistance to what's going on?
I think that's a really good question. those of you who obviously most of you remember, right after 9/11, so many people, I think Susan Sarandon was one, obviously Bill Maher, politically incorrect, were chastised. I know Susan Sarandon was supposed to speak somewhere, and they canceled it because she said something honest, I can't remember what it was, about that day. And so there's a tendency, and I think, again, this goes into the bigger picture of how we self-edit and curb what we may say. Obviously, as the years pass, it becomes easier to look back and to analyze what happened on that day in our response. The Patriot Act was pretty much written before 9/11, and I think, unfortunately, that provided an opportunity to push through that really ill-thought-out legislation, but that had, I think, another agenda, which was to find a way to really seize. What we're talking about is control. A government with a corporate partner that wants to amass as much information as it can, and I think it is a race for information, and ultimately to do that, it means they can control the population. So I think it's really important that people start analyzing, you know, what happened, write about it, you know, talk to others, make films, creative ways, because it's become clear that the current system that is in place is not working, and it's not just those of us who tend to be critics of an overreaching government, but committees that have been appointed by the president are saying the system isn't working. It's wasting a lot of money. Mike German, who used to work for the FBI, who is now at the Brennan Center in New York, is a big fan of bringing back those restraints on how law enforcement can open cases and how they do investigations. So I think it's a good time to analyze. I think, again, Mr. Snowden's revelations and others that are coming out by independent journalists or, you know, these are all important pieces of a puzzle that help us make sense of really what happened after a tragedy and perhaps how we could handle it better.
So you see opportunism rather than some sort of intent.
We do have to move on. One quick, is there a quick answer to this?
I think there was opportunism. Look, you know, the CIA, the FBI, they do nasty stuff. We know that through reading the history books. And government, when given tools to control a populace, will, and we have to hope they won't use it for evil. But the problem we face now, I think, as I mentioned, is fabulous technology that can do wonderful things and open up our lives. But it can also be used, as we're seeing, to spy on us and do other things we may not be aware of.
Because of the revelations by Edgar Snowden, the White House and Congress have had to respond. And I wonder if you could evaluate what you think about the Obama administration's response, the committee they set up, the recommendations they made, the response of Obama to the recommendations, and whether you think it's just a sort of, all right, we'll do a few things and go on the same way, or you think it might make a difference.
Well, I read the report. I liked some of the recommendations. I mean, if I had my way, I would say just stop collecting data and storing it, you know, maybe for limited purposes. But I don't think we need to collect everything that everyone is doing. That's really the only way we're going to end some of the abuses. But that won't happen. I think that Obama has obviously been a disappointment as a constitutional scholar who has really surprised a lot of people who thought we were going to see a change, but we've seen more of the same and worse. So I think it's important that we have these committees. I wish Obama would have taken the recommendations, you know, would have enacted more of them. I think that they're out there. We're going to see more recommendations. We just need to keep up the pressure. And I always say creativity in how we work for social change, you know, in the streets, litigation, and there's a lot of good litigation going on by the Electronic Frontier Foundation. A lot of this rests in the hand of people and nonprofit organizations, advocacy groups that are trying to educate and really push our elected officials to make change. I think we just have to try on all fronts.
You and the media speak eloquently about the problems that information gathering, storage, and analysis present. And as a watchful, mindful reader of the above, I have a growing sense of despair. I feel that every one of our three branches of government are turning a deaf ear or a blind eye to the problems of individual privacy and rights. Our president has been, as you said politely, a disappointment. His attorney general has prosecuted as many cases for violation, as they see it, of government secrecy for media disclosures as the Bush administration, virtually speaking, if not more so. We have in the Roberts Court the most hostile judiciary possible. You look at the composition of FISTA court appointed by the Chief Justice. You look at the court's rulings on standing, which denies access to the courts. And then you need only go to Congress to have another element of despair piled on. And my question to you is, from my own perspective, the only thing I think I can do, and I was in Office Max and I saw a paper shredder and I thought, oh my God, you know, what good is that in this era? But I'm trying to be more vigilant about my own data. But I find I can't engage in the discourse of commerce or healthcare without giving a date of birth, a social security number, or the like. And how do you avoid this turning into despair, what I'll describe as despair into resignation, because it doesn't appear to be a remedy?
What I do, I've stopped giving my social security number on forms. Why do we all feel we have to be compliant when given a form that asks for your social security number? There's a great website. It's a California-based group, the Privacy, I think it's a Privacy Information Center, but if you put privacy and fact sheet in your search engine, it has wonderful fact sheets on things just like that. And I think that it may seem small, but I now love going to my doctor and just not filling that in and waiting for someone to say, you have to fill that in. No one has. You don't have to, except for the IRS and maybe one or two other certain sales that have to be reported to the IRS. You don't have to give out your social. Other information, we have to start just being mindful when you get a product registration form, when it asks for things that are not related to the refrigerator, when it says, like, how many kids in your family, or, you know, what's your income? You don't need to fill it out. You don't need to fill out any of these forms. And so going to that privacy group's website, I thought was, you know, everyone needs to read this, because simple things, we can't all encrypt everything we do. You know, we have different layers, each of us, of technical proficiency in how much we want to invest. So I would just say, start with little things. And, you know, if everyone stops filling out certain forms, it makes it easier for the next, you know, if we're going to resist one thing, we move on to the next. I firmly believe that stories of people, which is why I included some at the end of the book, stories of ordinary people like us taking a stand make a huge difference. I was on the plane yesterday watching Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, which I recommend everyone rewatch. I, you know, was smiling and almost crying, because it's so refreshing. Everything that you said resonates with me, it can get pretty discouraging. But you know what? We still, the power of the people, look at what happened with Occupy. Some people say Occupy was a failure. I think it was a huge success. I read that you had over 1,000 people in an Occupy event here a couple of years ago. That, you know, we are the 99% is now a global slogan. We can do more of that. And with the internet, I think we have the power to organize.
Hi. My name is Tom, and I'm a recovered FBI agent.
Hi. Hi, Tom.
I spent 25 years in the agency, retired back in 94, but I would like to just make a couple of short statements and then a question at the end. First of all, I do know the answer to the gentleman's question over here about the CIA or intelligence gathering overseas. That is and has been for a long time one of the primary functions of CIA is interviewing not only American business people coming back from foreign countries, but also interviewing foreign citizens that happen to be over here for business at times, interviewing Americans that are expats living in these other countries, gathering this industrial information. And that's been pretty prevalent for decades. The next thing is, I worked in the FBI starting back in 1970 under J. Edgar Hoover, and I was there when the Levy guidelines came in, and I can say with great confidence that the FBI was able to function well within the limits of the Constitution, operating under the Levy guidelines, and I don't think there was any reason for them to have been changed so drastically as they were under subsequent administrations. I think it's the book that you have written and the talk you've given tonight are extremely important. The American people need to find out, as you've indicated tonight, just how extensive this surveillance is that moves way beyond. In the case of the FBI, it started out as a criminal investigative organization rather than an intelligence one. And of course, since 9/11, it has become predominantly an intelligence organization, I think, to its detriment. But my question is, near the end of your talk, you gave a number of things that you think these agencies need to do and that American society needs to do to turn some of this around. I'm not too optimistic that that's ever going to happen. I'm wondering what your thoughts are along that line.
Well, it's, I think, from my perspective, in the last year, people in this country and around the world have learned a lot. You know, for some people, it wasn't that much of a surprise, but for many, it was a wake-up call. I can't ever give up hope. Again, you know, the social progress that has been made in this country over the last 100 years and more, all of these changes were because one or more people took a stand, a principled stand, and said, you know, I'm going to do the right thing. I'm going to make a statement, whether I put my life on the line or risk imprisonment. The cause, and that's what Jimmy Stewart was saying in the movie, is the Constitution, all of those values are bigger than us. It's bigger than one individual. It's bigger than a corporation. And I can't give up hope that we can't make a change. We have to. We, the people, are supposed to be telling our elected officials what to do, not the other way around. We need greater transparency, and we just, I think if, you know, years ago, I got a master's in mass communication, and I remember they said then, I don't know if it's still true, that one-on-one communication was still then the most effective form of communication. Now we have the internet. I see it as a tool that enhances that, but I still think we have to reach out to our fellow friends, colleagues, say, look, you know, did you read about this? Bring people up to speed. I mean, I have stacks of New York Times in my office and at home because I'm so fascinated by the business pages. Each of these stories is like, you know, Google did this or someone else did this. There's a lawsuit. To me, it's all a fascinating narrative that is we need to make a part of our lives because it's happening quickly. Most of the time, laws are happening without our knowledge. Changes like, you know, to the guidelines, who knew about those changes? And yet it impacts us so greatly. So I think, I really just think, stay educated, talk to people, get involved, whether you can't, you know, go to a protest, find another way to get involved. Support a local group that's doing the work that you believe in. Find a cause that touches you and make it something that you do as part of your life. It's very invigorating.
Okay, this will be our last question.
Okay. Well, one gentleman kind of covered it when he said, we have an executive, we have the Supreme Court, and we have the Congress, who are all against we, the 99%. They're against the Constitution. They're against international law. Well, now there's got to be some federal judges who still, when they swear to uphold the Constitution, want to do that. We, the people, want the Constitution. Bush called it a scrap of paper. That's the point where, why don't we go in mass? A million of us. Find a federal judge, go and say, citizen's arrest. Go to these people, go to Bush, go to Rumsfeld, go to the, and take them before a federal judge. Take them to the Hague. We've got to do this. We cannot let these people get away with this. Our country's gone. There's no America now. There's been a coup. There's no America anymore. It's up to us to bring it back.
Well said. It's up to us. Totally agree. And there are some judges that make brave decisions. Even after 9/11, there were some judges, there were a few police departments that refused to carry out orders on the West Coast, of course. and you know what? When that happens, we need to write letters to the editors. We need to tell people, this is a brave person. They did the right thing. I mean, we need to take those few examples and show that that's what we want. So I agree with you.
How about applause? Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.